The Lady of Moga. They met once when they were both 19, and again when they were 23. That they met only once after that, and long after, was Andra's fault. It was not the kind of fault one would have expected of him, seeing him at 19 years old, a boy poised above his destiny like a hawk. One saw the eyes, the hawk eyes, clear, unblinking, fierce. Only when they were closed in sleep did anyone ever see his face, beautiful and passive, the face of the hero. For heroes do not make history, that is the historian's job, but passive, let themselves be borne along, swept up to the crest of the tide of change, of chance, of war. She was Isabella Oriana Mogiscar, daughter of the Counts of Hela and the Princes of Moga. She was a princess, and lived in a castle on a hill above the Molson River. Young Andra Kalinskar was coming to seek her hand in marriage. The Kalinskar family coach rolled for half an hour through the domains of Moga, came through a walled town and up a steep, fortified hill, passed under a gateway 6 feet thick, and stopped before the castle. The high wall was made splendid by an infinite tracery of red vines, for it was autumn. The chestnut trees of the forecourt were flawless gold. Over the golden trees, over the towers, stood the faint, clear, windy sky of late October. Andra looked about him with interest. He did not blink. In the windowless ground-floor hall of the castle, among saddles and muskets and hunting, riding, fighting gear, the two old companions-at-arms, Andra's father and Prince Mogiscar, embraced. Upstairs, where windows looked out to the river, and the rooms were furnished with the comforts of peace, the Princess Isabella greeted them. Reddish fair, with a long, calm, comely face and gray-blue eyes, autumn as a young girl, she was tall, taller than Andra. When he straightened from his bow to her, he straightened farther than usual, but the difference remained at least an inch. They were 18 at table that night, guests, dependents, and the Mogiscars, Isabella, her father, and her two brothers. George, a cheerful 15-year-old, talked hunting with Andra. The older brother and heir, Brent, glanced at him a couple of times, listened to him once, and then turned his fair head away, satisfied. His sister would not stoop to this Kalinskar fellow. Andra set his teeth, and in order not to look at Brant, looked at his mother, who was talking with the Princess Isabella. He saw them both glance at him, as if they had been speaking of him. In his mother's eyes he saw, as usual, pride and irony. In the girl's, what? Not scorn, not approval. She simply saw him. She saw him clearly. It was exhilarating. He felt for the first time that esteem might be a motive quite as powerful as desire. Late the next afternoon, leaving his father and his host to fight old battles, he went up to the roof of the castle and stood near the round tower to look out over the Molson and the hills in the dying, windy, golden light. She came to him through the wind, across the stone. She spoke without greeting, as to a friend. "I've been wanting to talk with you." Her beauty, like the golden weather, cheered his heart, made him both bold and calm. "And I with you, Princess." "I think you're a generous man," she said. There was a pleasant, husky tone, almost guttural, in her light voice. He bowed a little, and compliments pranced through his mind, but something prompted him to say only, "Why?" "It's quite plain to see," she replied, impatient. "May I speak to you as one man to another?" "As one man?" "Dom Andra, when I first met you yesterday, I thought, I have met a friend at last. Was I right?" Did she plead or challenge? He was moved. He said, "You were right." "Then may I ask you, my friend, not to try to marry me. I don't intend to marry." There was a long silence. "I shall do as you wish, Princess." "And without arguing," cried the girl, all at once a light, a flame. "Oh, I knew you were a friend. Please, Dom Andra, don't feel sad or foolish. I refuse the others without even thinking about it. With you, I had to think. You see, if I refuse to marry, my father will send me to the convent. So I can't refuse to marry. I can only refuse each suitor, you see? He did, though if she had given him time to think, he would have thought that she must in the end accept either marriage or the convent, being, after all, a girl. But she did not give him time to think. So the suitors keep coming. And it's like Princess Ranya in the tale, you know, with her three questions, and all the young men's heads stuck on poles around the palace. It is so cruel and wearisome. She sighed, and leaning on the parapet beside Andra, looked out over the golden world, smiling, inexplicable, comradely. I wish you'd ask me the three questions, he said, wistful. I have no questions. I have nothing to ask. Nothing to ask that I could give you, to be sure. Ah, you have already given me what I asked of you, not to ask me. He nodded. He would not seek her reasons. His rebuffed pride and a sense of her vulnerability forbade it, and so in her sweet perversity she gave them to him. What I want, Dom Andra, is to be left alone, to live my life, my own life, at least till I found out. The one thing I have questions to ask of is myself, to live my own life, to find out my own way. Am I too weak to do that? I was born in this castle. My people have been lords here for a long time. One gets used to it. Look at the walls. You can see why Moga has been attacked, but never taken. Ah, one's life could be so splendid. God knows what might happen. Isn't it true, Dom Andra? One mustn't choose too soon. If I marry, I know what will happen, what I'll do, what I'll be. And I don't want to know. I want nothing except my freedom. I think, Andra said with a sense of discovery, most women marry to get their freedom. Then they want less than I do. There's something inside me, in my heart, a brightness and a heaviness. How can I describe it? Something that exists and does not yet exist, which is mine to carry, and not mine to give up to any man. Did she speak, Andra wondered, of her virginity or of her destiny? She was very strange, but it was a princely and a touching strangeness. In all she said, however arrogant and naive, she was most estimable, and though desire was forbidden, she had reached straight into him, to his tenderness, the first woman who had ever done so. She stood there quite alone within him, as she stood beside him and alone. Does your brother know your mind? Brant? No. My father is gentle. Brant is not. When my father dies, Brant will force me to marry. Then you have no one? I have you, she said, smiling, which means that I have to send you away. But a friend is a friend, near or far. Near or far, call to me, if you need a friend, princess. I will come. He spoke with a sudden dignity of passion, vowing to her, as a man when very young will vow himself entirely to the rarest and most imperiled thing he has beheld. She looked at him, shaken from her gentle, careless pride, and he took her hand, having earned the right. Beyond them the river ran red under the sunset. I will, she said. I was never grateful to a man before, Dom Andra. He left her, full of exultation, but when he got to his room he sat down, feeling suddenly very tired and blinking often, as if on the point of tears. That was their first meeting, in the wind and golden light, on the top of the world, at 19. The Kalinskars went back home. 4 years passed, in the second of which, 1640, began the civil struggle for succession known as the War of the Three Kings. Like most petty noble families, the Kalinskars sided with Duke Gibbon Sobinskar in his claim to the throne. Andra took arms in his troops. By 1643, when they were fighting town by town down through the Molson province to Krasnoy, Andra was a field captain. To him, while Sobinskar pushed on to the capital to be crowned, was entrusted the siege of the last stronghold of the Loyalists east of the river, the town and castle of Moga. So on a June day, Andra lay, chin on folded arms, on the rough grass of a hilltop, gazing across a valley at the slate roofs of the town, the walls rising from a surf of chestnut leaves, the round tower, the shining river beyond. "Captain, where do you want the culverins placed?" The old prince was dead, and Brant Mogaskar had been killed in March, in the east. Had King Gullhelm sent troops across the river to the defense of his defenders, his rival might not be riding now to Krasnoy to be crowned. But no help had come, and the Mogaskars were besieged now in their own castle. Surrender they would not. Andra's lieutenant, who had arrived some days before him with the light troops, had requested a parley with George Mogaskar, but he had not even seen the prince. He had been received by the princess, he said, a handsome girl, but hard as iron. She had refused to parley. "Mogaskar does not bargain. If you lay siege, we shall hold the castle. If you follow the pretender, we shall wait here for the king." Andra lay gazing at the tawny walls. "Well, Sotin, the problem's this. Do we take the town first, or the castle?" But that was not the problem at all. The problem was much crueler than that. Lieutenant Sotin sat down by him and puffed out his round cheeks. "Castle," he said. "Lose weeks taking that town, and then still have the castle to breach." "Breach that? With the guns we've got? Once we're in the town, they'll accept terms in the castle." "Captain, that woman in there isn't going to accept any terms." "How do you know?" "I've seen her." "So have I," said Andra. "We'll set the culverins there, at the south wall of the town. We'll begin bombardment tomorrow at dawn. We were asked to take the fort as it stands. It'll have to be at the cost of the town. They give us no choice." He spoke grimly, but was in his heart elated. He would give her every chance, the chance to withdraw from the hopeless fight, and the chance also to prove herself, to use the courage she had felt heavy and shining in her breast, like a sword lying secret in its sheath. He had been a worthy suitor, a man of her own mettle, and had been rejected. Fair enough. She did not want a lover, but an enemy, and he would be a worthy, an estimable one. He wondered if she yet knew his name, if someone had said, "Field Captain Kellenskar is leading them," and she had replied in her lordly, gentle, unheeding way, "Andra Kellenskar?" Frowning, perhaps, to learn that he had joined the Duke against the King, and yet not displeased, not sorry to have him as her foe. They took the town, at the cost of 3 weeks and many lives. Later, when Kellenskar was Marshal of the Royal Army, he would say, when drunk, "I can take any town. I took Moga." The walls were ingeniously fortified, the castle arsenal seemed inexhaustible, and the defenders fought with terrible spirit and patience. They withstood shelling and assaults, put out fires barehanded, ate air, in the last extremity fought face to face, house after house, from the town gate up to the castle's scarp, and when taken prisoner they said, "It's her." He had not seen her yet. He had feared to see her in the thick of that carnage, in the narrow, ruined streets. From them, at evening, he kept looking up to the battlements 100 feet above, the smoking cannon emplacements, the round tower, tawny red in sunset, the untouched castle. "Wonder how we could get a match into the powder store," said Lieutenant Sotin, puffing his cheeks out cheerfully. His captain turned on him, his hawk eyes red and swollen with smoke and weariness. "I'm taking Moga as it stands. Blow up the best fort in the country, would you? Because you're tired of fighting? By God, I'll teach you respect, Lieutenant." "Respect for what? Or whom?" Sotin wondered, but held his tongue. As far as he was concerned, Kellenskar was the finest officer in the army, and he was quite content to follow him, into madness or wherever. They were all mad with the fighting, with fatigue, with the glaring, grilling heat and dust of summer. They bombarded and made assaults at all hours to keep the defenders from rest. In the dark of early morning, Andra was leading a troop up to a partial breach they had made by mining the outer wall when a foray from the castle met them. They fought with swords there in the darkness under the wall. It was a confused and ineffectual scrap, and Andra was calling his men together to retreat when he became aware that he had dropped his sword. He groped for it. For some reason, his hands would not grasp, but slid stupidly among clods and rocks. Something cold and grainy pressed against his face. The earth. He opened his eyes very wide and saw darkness. Two cows grazed in the inner courtyard, the last of the great herds of Moga. At 5 in the morning, a cup of milk was brought to the princess in her room, as usual, and a little while later, the captain of the fort came, as usual, to give her the night's news. The news was the same as ever, and Isabella paid little heed. She was calculating when King Gullhelm's forces might arrive, if her messenger had got to him. It could not be sooner than 10 days. 10 days was a long time. It was only 3 days now since the town had fallen, and that seemed quite remote. An event from last year, from history. However, they could hold out 10 days, even 2 weeks if they had to. Surely the king would send them help. "They'll send a messenger to ask about him," Brio was saying. "Him?" She turned her heavy look on the captain. "The field captain." "What field captain?" "I was telling you, princess, the foray took him prisoner this morning." "A prisoner?" "Bring him here at once." "He's got a saber cut on the head, princess." "Can he speak?" "I'll go to him. What's his name?" "Kalinskar." She followed Bria through gilt bedrooms where muskets were stacked on the beds, down a long parquetted corridor that crunched underfoot with crystal from the shattered candle sconces, to the ballroom on the east side, now a hospital. Oaken bedsteads, pillared and canopied, their curtains open and awry, stood about on the sweep of floor like stray ships in a harbor after storm. The prisoner was asleep. She sat down by him and looked at his face, a dark face, serene, passive. Something within her grieved. Not her will, which was resolute, but she was tired, mortally tired and grieved, as she sat looking at her enemy. He moved a little and opened his eyes. She recognized him then. After a long time, she said, "Dom Andra." He smiled a little and said something inaudible. "The surgeon says your wound is not serious. Have you been leading the siege?" "Yes," he said quite clearly. "From the start?" "Yes." She looked up at the shuttered windows, which let in only a dim hint of the hot July sunlight. "You're our first prisoner. What news of the country?" "Given Sovenskar was crowned in Krasnoy on the first. Gullhelm is still in Aesnar." "You don't bring good news, Captain," she said softly, with indifference. She glanced round the other beds down the great room and motioned Bria to stand back. It irked her that they could not speak alone, but she found nothing to say. "Are you alone here, Princess?" He had asked her a question like that the other time, up on the rooftop in the sunset. "Brant is dead," she answered. "I know. But the younger brother, I hunted with him in the marshes that time. George is here now. He was at the defense of Castra. A mortar blew up. It blinded him. Did you lead the siege at Castra, too?" "No, I fought there." She met his eyes only for a moment. "I'm sorry for this," she said. "For George, for myself, for you, who swore to be my friend." "Are you?" "I'm not. I've done what I could. I've served your glory. You know that even my own soldiers sing songs about you, about the Lady of Moga, like an archangel on the castle walls. In Krasnoy they talk about you. They sing the songs. Now they can say that you took me prisoner, too. They talk of you with wonder. Your enemies rejoice in you. You've won your freedom. You have been yourself." He spoke quickly, but when he stopped and shut his eyes a moment to rest, his face looked still again, youthful. Isabella sat for a minute saying nothing, then suddenly got up and went out of the room with the hurrying, awkward gait of a girl in distress, graceless in her heavy, powder-stained dress. Andra found that she was gone, replaced by the old captain of the fort, who stood looking down at him with hatred and curiosity. "I admire her as much as you do," he said to Bria. "More. More even than you here in the castle. More than anyone. For 4 years. But Bria, too, was gone. "Get me some water to drink," he said furiously, and then lay silent, staring at the ceiling. A roar and shudder, what was it? Then three dull thuds, deep and shocking, like the pain in the root of a tooth. Then another roar, shaking the bed. He understood finally that this was the bombardment heard from inside. Sotin was carrying out orders. "Stop it," he said, as the hideous racket went on and on. "Stop it, I need to sleep. Stop it, Sotin, cease firing." When he woke, free of delirium, it was night. A person was sitting near the head of his bed. Between him and the chair, a candle burned. Beyond the yellow globe of light about the candle flame, he could see a man's hand and sleeve. "Who's there?" he asked uneasily. The man rose and showed him, in the full light of the candle, a face destroyed. Nothing was left of the features but mouth and chin. These were delicate, the mouth and chin of a boy of about 19. The rest was newly healed scar. "I'm George Mogiscar. Can you understand me?" "Yes," Andra replied from a constricted throat. "Can you sit up to write? I can hold the paper for you." "What should I write?" They both spoke very low. "I wish to surrender my castle," Mogiscar said. "But I wish my sister to be gone, out of here, to go free. After that, I shall give up the fort to you. Do you agree?" "Wait. Write your lieutenant. Tell him that I will surrender on this one condition. I know Sovnskar wants this fort. Tell him that if she is detained, I shall blow the fort and you and myself and her into dust. You see, I have nothing much to lose myself." The boy's voice was level, but a little husky. He spoke slowly and with absolute definiteness. The condition is just," Andra said. Mogiscar brought an inkwell into the light, felt for its top, dipped the pen, gave pen and paper to Andra, who had managed to get himself half sitting up. When the pen had been scratching on the paper for a minute, Mogiscar said, "I remember you, Kalinskar. We went hunting in the long marsh. You were a good shot." Andra glanced at him. He kept expecting the boy to lift off that unspeakable mask and show his face. "When will the princess leave? Shall my lieutenant give her escort across the river?" "Tomorrow night at 11. 4 men of ours will go with her. 1 will come back to warrant her escape. It seems the grace of God that you led this siege, Kalinskar. I remember you. I trust you." His voice was like hers, light and arrogant, with that same husky note. "You can trust your lieutenant, I hope, to keep this secret." Andra rubbed his head, which ached. The words he had written jiggled and writhed on the paper. "Secret? You wish these terms to be kept? You want her escape to be made secretly? Do you think I wish it said that I sold her courage to buy my safety? Do you think she'd go if she knew what I am giving for her freedom? She thinks she's going to beg aid from King Gullhelm while I hold out here. Prince, she will never forgive. It's not her forgiveness I want, but her life. She's the last of us. If she stays here, she'll see to it that when you finally take the castle, she is killed. I am trading Moga Castle and her trust in me against her life." "I'm sorry, Prince," Andra said. His voice quavered with tears. "I didn't understand. My head's not very clear." He dipped the pen in the inkwell the blind man held, wrote another sentence, then blew on the paper, folded it, put it in the prince's hand. "May I see her before she goes?" "I don't think she'll come to you, Kalinskar. She is afraid of you. She doesn't know that it's I who will betray her." Mogiscar put out his hand into his unbroken darkness. Andra took it. He watched the tall, lean, boyish figure go hesitatingly off into the dark. The candle burned on at the bedside, the only light in the high, long room. Andra lay staring at the golden, pulsing sphere of light around the flame. 2 days later, Moga Castle was surrendered to its besiegers, while its lady, unknowing and hopeful, rode on across the neutral lands westward to Aesnar. and they met the third and last time only by chance. Andra had not availed himself of Prince George Mogiscar's invitation to stop at the castle on his way to the border war in 47. To avoid the sight of his first notable victory, to refuse a proud and grateful ex-enemy was unlike him, suggesting either fear or a bad conscience, in neither of which did he much indulge himself. Nonetheless, he did not go to Moga. It was 37 years later, at a winter ball in Count Alexis Heliskar's house in Krasnoy, that somebody took his arm and said, "Princess, let me present Marshal Kalinskar, the Princess Isabella Proyedskar." He made his usual deep bow, straightened up, and straightened up still more, for the woman was taller than he by an inch at least. Her gray hair was piled into the complex rings and puffs of the current fashion. The panels of her gown were embroidered with arabesques of seed pearls. Out of a broad, pale face, her blue-gray eyes looked straight at him, an inexplicable, comradely gaze. She was smiling. "I know, Dom Andra," she said. "Princess," he muttered, appalled. She had got heavy. She was a big woman now, imposing, firmly planted. As for him, he was skin and bone, and lame in the right leg. "My youngest daughter, Oriana." The girl of 17 or 18 curtsied, looking curiously at the hero, the man who in 3 wars, in 30 years of fighting, had forced a broken country back into one piece, and earned himself a simple and unquestionable fame. "What a skinny little old man," said the girl's eyes. "Your brother, Princess." "George died many years ago, Dom Andra. My cousin Enrique is lord of Moga now. But tell me, are you married? I know of you only what all the world knows. It's been so long, Dom Andra. 2x this child's age." Her voice was maternal, plaintive. The arrogance, the lightness were gone, even the huskiness of passion and of fear. She did not fear him now. She did not fear anything. Married, a mother, a grandmother, her day over, a sheath with the sword drawn, a castle taken, no man's enemy. "I married, Princess. My wife died in childbirth while I was in the field, many years ago." He spoke harshly. She replied, banal, plaintive. "Ah, but how sad life is, Dom Andra." "You wouldn't have said that on the walls of Moga," he said, still more harshly, for it galled his heart to see her like this. She looked at him with her blue-gray eyes, impassive, simply seeing him. "No," she said, "that's true. And if I had been allowed to die on the walls of Moga, I should have died believing that life held great terror and great joy." "It does, Princess," said Andra Kalinskar, lifting his dark face to her, a man unabated and unfulfilled. She only smiled and said in her level, maternal voice, "For you, perhaps." Other guests came up, and she spoke to them, smiling. Andra stood aside, looking ill and glum, thinking how right he had been never to go back to Moga. He had been able to believe himself an honest man. He had remembered, faithfully, joyfully, for 40 years, the red vines of October, the hot blue evenings of midsummer in the siege. And now he knew that he had betrayed all that, and lost the thing worth having, after all. Passive, heroic, he had given himself wholly to his life, but the gift he had owed her, the soldier's one gift, was death, and he had withheld it. He had refused her. And now, at 60, after all the days, wars, years, countrysides of his life, now he had to turn back and see that he had lost it all, had fought for nothing, that there was no princess in the castle. 1640.